Hi, everyone. It's Jivana. I just want to come on for a moment and thank our sponsor, OfferingTree. They're an all-in-one, easy-to-use, community-backed business that saves you time, energy, and money as a yoga teacher. OfferingTree allows you to create a website in less than 30 minutes. Plus, you get a discount through Accessible Yoga. Just go to offeringtree.com/accessible yoga to get your discount today. Okay, here's our episode.
Welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. This podcast explores the teachings of yoga for self and collective transformation. We dive into how spirituality and philosophy can ignite social change. I share conversations with folks who are on the front lines of justice and liberatory movements, thought leaders, change makers, and healers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. And today we have with us a really special guest, Leila Higassi, who is an Egyptian, Italian, American singer, songwriter, a social media creator, a teacher, and activist in New York City. She uses music to advocate for Palestine, and that is one of her passions. And her adaptations of popular songs aim to help those in the pro-Palestinian movement and people who are pro-Palestine feel seen as they battle the absurdity of the occupations and Western propaganda. Leila is currently working on a protest album for Palestine and plans to donate the proceeds to the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. She's also in the process of recording her next project with her twin sister duo, Higassi. Thank you so much for joining me, Leila. And you and I met, in the Accessible Yoga, I think, one of the philosophy sessions that we did. So I've always enjoyed, first of all, being in community with you and seeing you just be so upfront and talented and doing all the things that you do. And I'm so glad to have this conversation with you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Could you share a little bit more about yourself, other than what I just read, and your path into the work?
Yeah, so I live in New York City, Staten Island, New York, specifically. I grew up here most of my life. And you can actually see the Statue of Liberty from here. So yeah, it's fun. And I have been a musician all my life. So pretty much since I was 5 years old, I've been singing, making up songs about various things, art supplies in school, whatever it was. I was always making a song about something. And, you know, I started taking piano lessons when I was maybe like 10 years old or so. And I loved being in chorus in school and all of those great things. And right. I actually can honestly say I wouldn't be a musician if it weren't for the public school system, right? And just like having that introduced to me in elementary school. So I'm really grateful for that. And now I'm a music teacher. So I teach piano and voice lessons for a living. I'm also a yoga teacher, and I like to be in lots of different places. So I've never really had just the one job. I have a lot of passions, and I find that they all really connect. And the activism work is something that I've gotten into recently in a formal way. So I'm in candidacy to be an organizer with the PSL. That's an organization, a national organization that does really great work. But also, you know, I grew up in the struggle around Palestine, as every Arab American, Arab kind of does. You know, when I was a kid, I remember really kind of being the only one of my friends who understood anything about this issue. So, you know, now it's like really amazing to see so many people who weren't informed before be so informed now. I think the tides have definitely changed, and it's really great to see.
Yeah. What was the thing that you said that your friends did not get into this much later, and you were, what was your, why did you get into this work and awareness about Palestine earlier on, you think?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like I said, I think every Arab person kind of grows up understanding the pain that's there around this. Yeah. And especially because it's such a taboo subject and has been really untouched, even a lot in a lot of social justice circles, it's been a taboo subject. So
yeah,
I think especially also growing up post 9/11, I was 11 years old when 9/11 happened, and just seeing, you know, and experiencing the ways that Muslim and Arab Americans were treated, and just Muslims and Arabs in general, and realizing in all of these wars how oftentimes dispensable Arab life really is to the West. That's an experience, you know, I can remember from a very early age, actually, like especially post 9/11, really feeling that. And I'm mixed also, like I'm half Italian also, but you know, my name is fully Arab and Egyptian. My last name is unmistakably Egyptian, actually, because it has a G in it. And we're the only country that pronounces the letter G like G. Every other country, it's like a J. So it's Hegazi is like, everyone knows I'm Egyptian, just like off the bat. Otherwise, it would be spelled with like a J or pronounced that way, like Hijazi. But yeah, so it's like almost impossible not to grow up around it. I mean, my dad remembered when he passed now, but he would tell me about when Egypt and Israel were at war. And, you know, it's not just also the cultural appropriation of Palestinian culture. It's also just Arab culture in general. So like, I remember being in a restaurant with my father and we saw the words Israeli salad on the menu and kind of watching him get a little upset about it. And not maybe if I didn't understand all the reasons why as a kid, it was still like, oh, okay, there's a lot of frustration and anger here. And and then, you know, as I get old, I got older, just understanding. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you as a follow-up, for folks who don't know the difference between what is Israeli salad and what does that really mean, can you share a little bit about that? And because food and appropriation is very close to my heart, so as an Indian, so I kind of understand that. So can you also share for the listeners?
Right, of course. Well, so basically the idea of Israeli food is a very, very hot topic, very contentious topic, especially in the Arab world and amongst Arabs, because a lot of the foods that are sometimes attributed to Israel are really foods that are eaten all over the MENA region, the Middle East and North Africa, and, you know, even kind of in Asia, you know, Turkey, like these foods span a really, really wide range of countries. So to call them Israeli food is a bit disingenuous, especially because, of course, Israel is a colonial entity. We're not bound, you know, we're not dancing around saying this anymore. It is also a new country, right? A new entity that has only existed formally since 1948. And these foods are so much older. So that's sort of where a lot of the frustration comes in. It's like, okay, well, you know, it's one thing for an Israeli family to sort of like open an Israeli restaurant and call it an Israeli food, but do people really understand kind of the nuance and the cultural, I want to say this, the span of countries that these foods belong to, because it's a huge span of countries that people are often kind of unfamiliar with to begin with. And it's also like a racialized aspect to it, because, you know, Israelis, whether they are white or not, I mean, Israel is a very diverse place, but they sort of get to enjoy the benefits of whiteness because of the way that the West has treated them and the way that the West regards them. So, you know, again, whether there's definitely, it's not that all Israelis are white, but it's sort of like they get to be white, right?
Yeah.
And there's a whole complicated like racial part of that too. So it's a hot topic.
I also think that, you know, culture and appropriation of specific elements like food, music, dance, yoga, you know, all of that is on a spectrum, and it rests in a dynamic of power. It doesn't come like out of the blue. It comes in a dynamic of power of people who can take things and make it their own, and people who are you know, who are left behind, of who are from the source culture and who are never really acknowledged for their contribution. So thank you for bringing that up.
Absolutely.
What I know we were going to talk about other sources for people who are away from even identifying as Palestinian or Arab or any of that. For folks who are not a part of these cultures, how can we be allies or how can we be in solidarity?
So I think the first step is listening to Palestinian voices in particular, especially right now, because mm-hmm. their voices have not always been heard or valued, right? So mm-hmm. there's really a lot of catching up to do, mm-hmm. I want to say, because the West has sort of controlled the narrative for so long and only given the microphone to certain people yep. to uphold that narrative. So I think the most important thing right now, above all else, is to center those voices. And it sounds obvious, but you know, it's really not. Like, I think some people, of course, are going to need to hear Jewish voices speak about Palestine in order to really fully empathize and understand that, no, this movement is not inherently anti-Semitic. It is not, you know, anti-Jewish in any way, and they need that reassurance. But I think, you know, sometimes I feel, as much as I appreciate our Jewish allies, which is, of course I do, it should be enough to listen to Palestinian voices mm-hmm. and Arab voices. And we need to ask that question of like, well, you know, why do we need, for example, like a Western source to sort of stand with us in order to be heard? Mm-hmm. And I'm not Palestinian, so I still, you know, I'm still saying like, let's center Palestinian voices first and foremost when it mm-hmm. comes to any conversation about the occupation. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's really where it has to start for anything productive to happen, because there's been such an imbalance so long, just in the way that this is talked about, even on a base level.
Yeah, no, I totally understand.
Hi, everyone. I just want to pop in here really quick and remind you about our sponsor, Offering Tree. As yoga teachers, we are our own business managers, website designers, and producers. It's a lot. And Offering Tree offers an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to succeed while we're doing all the things. And I'd just like to say that through this partnership with the Love of Yoga podcast, Offering Tree has shown that it's committed to supporting accessibility and equity in the yoga world. Offering Tree is a public benefit corporation, and they're driven by a mission of wellness accessibility, which we share with them at Accessible Yoga. As an Offering Tree user, you'll get to join a supportive educational community, and you'll also get free webinars with top experts in wellness and entrepreneurship. And of course, you get a discount. So go to offeringtree.com/accessibleyoga to learn more and to get your discount. Okay, let's go back to the episode.
And we have briefly talked about this, and you also alluded to that right now about how mainstream media has sort of framed it in a certain way or completely erased the story until very recently they've just started picking up threads, and that too framing it as like a war or, you know, with very particular kind of language. And so social media and presence and talking about that becomes absolutely integral, not only with Palestine, but so many other conversations, like for Sudan, for Congo, you know, all of that. So where do you place social media and the voices in there as a really big part of the movement?
Yeah, I think the movement is so dependent on social media, and social media is really the biggest determining factor right now. And the biggest, I want to say, this has been the factor in changing mm-hmm. public opinion across mm-hmm. the entire world. We're seeing the entire world rise up for Palestine. If you watch Western news, it's almost just a blip. You know, they barely yeah. cover these massive protests that are happening. It's like media blackout. But yeah. the public discourse around this issue has changed so much because on social media, narratives can't easily be controlled. And that's actually why the censorship is so bad, which is a whole other conversation, right? We can't even necessarily say free Palestine loud and proud the way we want to, because, you know, Meta in particular is censoring us so much. But Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, just being able to shine light on what's actually happening without mm-hmm. that filter of Western media bias has been so crucial to why people are changing their minds on this mm-hmm. issue. Because mm-hmm. I don't think it's that people intend to be ignorant about it, but unfortunately, Western media leaves us really very little choice.
Yeah.
Because like you said, when did they start the clock? When yeah. did they start reporting? So there was October 7th, but does anyone know what happened on October 6th?
Yeah.
And October 5th and every day before that? Probably not, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree. I do think there are different ways of getting into any sort of movement work. And I know that we also are looking at what skills do we have and how can we use this in a way which is authentic and sustainable. So I know for you, it's music. Has music always been a part of your activism work?
Somewhat. So it's funny because, as you mentioned, I'm in a band with my twin sister, and she was always the political twin who was mm-hmm. out there, you know, very outspoken on the news, doing whatever she was doing, having political debates. And I was the one who was just trying to make like pop, R&B, whatever I was doing. And I think at the end of the day, part of that for me was that if you're Muslim, if you're Arab and you live in the West, you're identity is just inherently political. So I never really set out to be political with my music, yeah. but then, you know, once my sister and I became a band, we thought we would just make music, and however it turned out, it turned out. But yeah, it turned out to be quite political. We started mm-hmm. writing songs about the immigration issue and the Here to Stay movement and so many things. And just, I don't know, it was maybe a little bit naive to think we would really stay away from politics. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think yeah. for the first like month or so of this genocide, I really didn't have the ability to use music this way. I don't really think I had the ability to do much of anything. I felt like I was in a state of almost paralysis. But then what happened was, it was Christmas time and I was hearing all these Christmas carols around me, and everybody was sort of going on like there was nothing wrong. This is what I was seeing around me, right? It's Christmas in New York, everyone's holiday shopping. And other than a few Palestine strikes, right, where we tried to like, you know, particular, like actually stop spending money on particular days, it didn't really feel like much was happening. And I just started like singing Christmas songs with lyrics about Palestine.
Yeah.
And then it became this thing where now we're covering pop songs and maybe people will get it if we do this. And I don't know if that was like a conscious thought, but it started to come out of me. And then once it started to come out of me, it literally did not stop. And this whole thing has been a surprise to me as much as it is to everyone else in my life, to be honest.
No, it's brilliant. And I remember seeing it and I was like, oh, wow, this is Leila, you know, this is amazing. So I'm so glad you're doing this. And I also wanted to kind of like touch base about accessibility and activism, right? For people who cannot go and march and be in solidarity in a very visible out there kind of way and still want to do things. I know you want to like bring that conversation in too because of your own personal experiences. So can you share a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I have a chronic condition myself. I have fibromyalgia. Probably since about 2020, and it's been a very interesting life shift. So I can go to a protest if I feel okay. And then some days I'm not okay. And it's a little bit hard to predict how things are going to go.
Yeah.
And then some days I am okay. But then if I go, I used up all my spoons at the protest. And now I need to take off like a whole day after, because I was marching, you know, I was not able to go to the march this past weekend. It was March 2nd. It was the sort of global march, and it was raining in New York and people were standing in the rain. Like, and I am so proud of them, and I could not physically do it.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I don't think I consciously realized that protesting this way through music was a way to make protesting more accessible for me, but it became my way of speaking out in the way that I could, in a way that allowed me to kind of maintain my energy levels as I needed them. Because of course, you know, we're all, regardless of what causes we're standing with, you know, we live under capitalism, and we do have to work, and we do have to kind of be okay if we are to give. So I had to figure out ways to protest that were more sustainable for me, and also more predictable, to be honest, because like I said, sometimes going to a march or doing particular things, like, it, I don't know how I'm going to feel on any given day, but I know I'll probably be okay enough to sit at the piano. Maybe. I haven't made a lot of videos lately, actually, because I've just been like really going through some flares of this condition. So yeah, it's been a very interesting journey, and but also kind of empowering at the same time, because I've figured out that I can do this in a way that actually makes sense for me, and that I have a sort of different role in the resistance than a lot of people, which is kind of nice, you know, that I get to do, that I guess I get to use these things that I'm already doing for the cause.
No, I totally understand. And thank you for sharing that. And thank you for being in this conversation with me. I hope this doesn't take out that's, you know, the spoons that are so important for you. I really appreciate this. Anything else you want to share, Leila? And also, how can folks be in connection with you and uplift your work? I know we're going to be sharing some of the albums and that you've covered and as a part of the promotion for the podcast, but anything else you want to share and uplift?
So I recently released it's a very modest piano vocal demo. I just went into the studio with a friend of mine and said, hey, let's record a couple songs. And then there's one in particular that I said, okay, I guess we'll put this out and donate the money to a good cause. So the song, it's called If I Must Die, which is the title of a poem by the late Palestinian writer, poet, professor. He was really, really loved in the Palestinian community and in the world. And he was martyred in December by Israeli forces. He was killed along with his, I believe, his brother, his sister, and her four children. And he was still in the north of Gaza. His family, his wife and children, are still alive. So actually all of the proceeds for this song, which are, it's basically the lyrics of his poem, which I knew at the moment I heard it, I have to write a song to this, because yeah, it just hit me right in the heart. Ooh, everyone was sharing it right after he was martyred. And I just, you know, it was like probably the next day that I wrote this song, and it's only a minute and a half. It's a short poem, but you know, I released it on a really wonderful site called Bandcamp, which, if you want to support musicians, it's really the best one. I made a point not to release on Spotify because we want to donate more than pennies, and musicians, especially, you know, it's, and it can depend on which country you live in also, and which countries you're being streamed from, but we typically get only like 0.003 of a dollar of every stream. So it's incredibly low. It's incredibly low. So the thing that is so wonderful about Bandcamp, and why I chose to release there and focus on that, is that basically, first of all, I released on Bandcamp Friday, where all the proceeds go to the artist. So I got essentially 100% of everything on that day, which will be donated to the family of Rafaat Alarir, who was martyred in December. And it's really incredible that the Instagram pipeline actually got me to someone who could put the money into his family's hands. And it's, they're going to use that money to rebuild. And, you know, we're waiting on it also, in a sense, because aid is not getting into Gaza right now. So it's a whole complicated thing to actually get the money to them. But, you know, when money is able to go in, we know exactly where it has to go. And it's I'm just really actually touched by the Instagram community that made that possible. Right. It's, I have faith in people now.
I do. I really do. I mean, you should. We have no choice but to, you know. I do too. I do too. I've been seeing so much grace and so much just love pouring from people who are complete strangers for people who are so far away and concerned. And, you know, so I'm hoping that that kind of really is one of the ignitions needed, catalysts needed for some sort of change, radical change, which is so required. And I, you know, I really want to thank you for everything and all that you're doing. And we'll continue to, you know, obviously be in touch and share all the things that we need to. And thank you again for showing up. And I hope you get some rest at the end of this and take good care of yourself and your heart.
Thank you so much. You too. It's hard right now. We all need to take care of our hearts.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Leila.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Love of Yoga podcast, an offering from Accessible Yoga Association. Please support our work by becoming an ambassador or by visiting our online studio at accessibleyoga.org.